Internet Podcast. I'm Todd Pearson, here with my friend, partner, and 2011 Dutzing, also known as Norwegian Death Diving World Champion, co-host extraordinaire, Wes Brown.
How you doing, Todd? It's good to see you. Yeah, death diving, that's the thing, right? Oh, man. Oh, takes a lot of nerve.
It's Norwegian belly flopping to the extreme.
Yes, and it hurts. And it hurts because you're pretty far up.
It's like 10 meters, I think, something like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm terrible at the metric conversion, you know, so.
Yeah, well, that's our education system. We never really got glommed on to the whole metric system.
I did it in like eighth grade, and then high school, we just bailed on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, real quick.
Yes.
There's three different techniques in Dutzing, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right because I'm not Norwegian.
No, that sounds correct.
You got the straight over your head, arms extended technique, right?
Yep.
You got what's known as the Christ pose technique.
Yeah.
Arms extended out to the side.
Yep.
And then you have the tie one on technique,
yes,
which is where you put your hands behind your back, like you're tying an apron.
Right.
Which one do you subscribe to?
I mean, I've tried all three, but the tie one on is by far the best. It's the best splash. It's, you know, yeah. So anybody who's really starting off in the sport, really do the tie one on technique because that's the only way to do it.
Yeah. Cause you're like a lot more aerodynamic that way, right?
Yeah.
You're like a little cannonball.
Yeah.
Speaking of aprons
and tying one on.
I'm incredibly excited for our interview this week. Our guest is the author of four books, The Kitchen Linens Book, Apronisms, The Apron Book, and The Apron Chronicles. She's been featured on the program CBS Sunday Morning and NPR's All Things Considered. And she's also the creator of Taiwan On Day, which is celebrated annually on Thanksgiving Eve as an opportunity to put the give back into Thanksgiving through an act of kindness. She has an exhibit entitled Apron Chronicles, A Patchwork of American Recollections, which has been traveling the United States for the past 16 years and is currently on display here in Denver, Colorado through May 31st at History Colorado. Welcome to the program, Ellen Ann Geisel.
This is a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, this is incredible. I'm so excited to be here. I love your place here in Denver. It's beautiful.
The colors. Yes, I know. You can tell I'm a real color person. I think color affects everything, how people react to you, how you react to your environment. So I am just a big walking rainbow.
And your personality is just like that. It is. Yeah.
I like to think of myself as the excitement at the end of the rainbow.
There you go.
The journey with me can sometimes be a tad rocky, as my husband of, 45 years. It can be rocky sometimes, but the journey is always worth it.
Right. So do you ever get to the end of the rainbow with you? Or is it like the traditional rainbow where it keeps moving away and you just not quite ever get to the...
Yeah, you're chasing it.
Yeah, you're always chasing it.
Well, as you're going to find out during our interview, I am incapable of giving a yes or no answer. My whole life has been like this because I had such a traumatic experience and relationship with math that I decided to live my life without giving exactness. So you just asked me a question and I can't even remember
it is now. I don't even think we need to, I don't even think we care anymore that what the question was. It's just the
answer.
Something
about the journey. Yeah. I can't remember. I don't know.
Well,
that's how this is going to go. We need to keep tabs on each other or it's just going to be chaos.
I like chaos. And I think our listeners do too.
Yeah. Before we get started, tell our listeners where they can go to learn about you and your journey. You have a website.
I do. It's apronmemories.com, where I haven't updated all that well. I found that it's a little easier for me just to post on Instagram and then that automatically posts on Facebook. It sounds like I know what I'm doing. I have spent so much time having people explain this whole thing to me. Oh, my goodness. But it really is true. The attention spans are less today than they were in yesterday's world. So I find it when you have to just do it in such a short format, it also helps keep me sort of encapsulated and not flying off in 1,000 directions.
We're going to talk about aprons, as people well know.
Let's do.
Yes. From our introduction here, this journey with aprons starts back in North Carolina. And I think your beginning kind of gives the rest of your life context, as it does with most people. I know that speaking with you previous, that you were a bit of a adventurous, free spirit. Is that correct?
I became an adventurous, free spirit through my parent. You know, backstory here, have to tell it. I was groomed my entire life to be the wife of a successful man. I was going to have beautiful children. I was going to give fabulous parties. All of that sounds really good, except the locale, it was going to keep me in the South where girls like, you know, this is what girls of that time were raised to do. And in order to find this fabulous husband, my parents sent me to really the only school I could get into. It was called, I call it the University of Southern Hospitality, because I don't want to shame the school. It's not their fault that the only guys who were there when I was there, they were dumber in math than I was. And I refused to marry anybody who could not help my future children with their math homework. So after 2 years at the University of Southern Hospitality, I convinced my parents. I could tell there was something else going on out there. I had met a boy from Harvard. That's a whole other story, but I had met a boy from Harvard who introduced me. He was the first person I saw who wore jeans, who wasn't a hick, and he introduced me to Bob Dylan, and he gave me a Bob Dylan album, and I went back to my dorm room in, you know, the South, and I actually wrote down the lyrics to every single one of Bob Dylan's songs, and I thought, there's something going on out there in this big old world that I don't have a clue about, and I cannot stay here. Mr. Wright is not here. So I convinced my parents to let me go to art school in New York City, where I just had the most wonderful time. The birth control pill had come out by the time I hit New York City, and women's liberation. So it was this was absolutely, I just could not have been more excited and happy. And then after a couple of years in New York City, after I finished art school and all, I realized Mr. Wright was not riding the subway. And I went, oh. So I decided to take myself as far away from New York City as I could get without needing a passport. And that was Honolulu. And I arrive in Honolulu with a bicycle and a little Cub Scout backpack that held my belongings. I mean, I traveled light. I couldn't do it today, but I did it then. I stayed there a year, and I realized Mr. Wright was not on a surfboard. So I thought, well, maybe my parents are right, and he actually is back there in the South. So I start to head home, and I flew to San Francisco, where I went to a laundromat, and there was a bulletin board, and on it was a card, and it said, Riders Wanted. Durango, Colorado. And I had no clue where that was, but I knew it had to be going. You couldn't go west because you were in California. It must be going east. So I got in the car with complete strangers and they left me in Durango. And I went to Fort Lewis Community College was the name of it at the time. And I went to their student center and there was a bulletin board and there was a note on it. It said, Riders Wanted, Denver. And I thought, well, I don't know where that is, but but it's got to be out of here. So that took me to Denver. And because I was just so ridiculously without knowledge of geography, I didn't realize that those scary mountain passes we had gone over to get to Denver, there weren't anymore. That the rest of the way to North Carolina was flat. I didn't know that. So I got out of the car in Denver. And the only reason I'm here is I don't know geography. I called my parents and I said, I'm staying in Denver. And then, you know, a few months later, I met my husband on a blind date. So 3 years later, we got married. And that's my story.
And Mr. Wright was in Denver, Colorado, of all places.
Mr. Wright was in Denver, Colorado. And actually, this is like the wildest part of this whole crazy story. When I had lived in New York City, I would take the train down to Philadelphia I had a boyfriend who went to the University of Pennsylvania, and he belonged to a fraternity where, you know, I would go to the parties and everything. When I met my husband on that blind date, he looked at me and he said, "I've met you before. You used to date so-and-so, and you went to art school in New York City, and you used to take the train down to Penn and come to fraternity parties." He was exactly right. I mean, what is that? So we have this kind of funny backstory.
That's incredible.
That is.
And here's the interesting thing. The building we're in is on 12th and Pennsylvania, right?
Oh my goodness.
And now you live on Pennsylvania Street.
Gosh, I'm going to work that one.
So we have a connection only because I lived in Honolulu for a while too. I could see Alawea Canal from my back window. So I was living right on Waikiki, down in Waikiki area. Block and a half from the beach.
I was up by Diamond Head in a house, rented a bed in, there were beds in multiple bedrooms, and you just rented a bed, and that was an eye-opener. Yeah. But that's also where I learned to cook. The one dish that, actually, I must have been good at it because I wooed my husband with it.
Nice.
And my culinary gift to the world was brown rice and frozen fish sticks. That did it. 45 years.
There you go. Is that like your Sunday dinner now? Brown rice and fish sticks?
No, but I want to tell you, fish sticks. One of my daughters-in-law showed me, you know, oh, just make fish stick tacos. They're so much easier. And I'd never thought of that.
Right.
And honestly, they are. And I do that like once a week.
Oh, that's awesome.
I've done that too. It actually is really a great idea.
Do you make your own slaw?
I have. Yeah.
Well, that's my big contribution is making my own slaw.
Well, the slaw could make or break it,
yes,
right?
Like
that's
I agree. I agree.
That's right. The important ingredient in that whole mix.
Welcome to the cooking podcast.
Talk about recipes. So you hooked your husband with fish sticks.
Yes. And you know, it's funny because he is in the other room and he's working, but he can sometimes hear, you know, what's going on out in this room. And he does tell me that of all the stories I tell, that's the one I consistently I tell it the very same. So it's true. I've been known to bend the line, as you can imagine.
Well, we hope you bend some today.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure.
Just bend some lines. Yeah. I think that's cool.
Be like Bob Dylan. His whole life was.
Well, and I can't believe you met him. You know, she was introduced to Bob Dylan.
No, his album. Oh. Gotcha.
You did get me. Initially, I thought like he introduced you to really the Bob Dylan. And then I realized, oh, you meant his music.
Oh, which, gotcha.
Yeah.
Because you were living in the village at the time, right?
I went to school. My art school was down in the village.
Okay.
But I was living in a room in a big old rent-controlled house that was owned and managed by a French woman. And she just rented out the rooms and it was a very safe place. It was that or the Barbizon Hotel. Mm. That's the kind of thing, place that girls used to stay for generations.
Right.
As you learn to become a secretary or, you know, wife material.
So you get married to Hank.
Mm-hmm.
You're Prince Charming.
Mm-hmm.
And you continue to live here in Colorado. You guys moved down to Pueblo, is that correct?
We did. We met in Denver. He got a job doing law in Boulder. Boulder was so much fun in the 70s. And nobody stayed married. I saw that right away. It was way too much fun and nobody stayed married. So I knew that we needed to find a much smaller environment where we could live on a single salary and raise a family like it was the 50s and not the 70s. Because I was real comfortable with the 50s. I understood the roles. And it was my life's dream that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be like Harriet Nelson. And I wanted to, you know, have the control of the house and the menu and the laundry and everything else and raise children to boot. And spend my day where nobody knew what I did. Because that was the thing about that television show. She would wave them off every day, and nobody had a clue what she did until they came home from school, where she met them with a tray with, you know, chocolate milk and little sandwiches cut in shapes. And I thought, I can do this job. This is even better than I dreamed. So we needed a smaller place, though, a population where the single salary was going to be doable. And Pueblo has been very, very good to us. We raised our children there. My husband has his practice there. We have friends, family. You know, it's just a wonderful, smaller environment.
Yeah, I see in that Sunday morning piece that you did a number of years ago that you list Harriet Nelson as your influence growing up. You know, so how was that connection? What, just because you watched the show all the time, what drew you to her character at the time?
In the neighborhood that we were in, not a wealthy neighborhood, a real working neighborhood. All the moms stayed at home but mine. And my mother had been to college. My mother worked as an accountant in our father's business, which she was helping him build, you know, from the ground up. And she was not there to greet us with chocolate milk and sandwiches cut into little cute shapes and stuff like that, like all the other mothers. So I watched that Harriet, Ozzie and Harriet Nelson show, and what Harriet was doing appealed to me on more than just, you know, the level, you know, I'm making kind of a light of it. I was the oldest girl in a large family. The mothering thing came natural to me. The bossing around thing came really natural to me. And I thought, this is what I'm going to do with my life. And then, to the absolute delight of our family, my parents had one more child, and she arrived when I was in the sixth or seventh grade. And by that time, you know, she was like a living baby doll. And I thought, this is exactly what I want to do with the rest of my life. I want to have a home that I'm in charge of, and I want to have babies, and I want to stay home and raise them. So my mother, who certainly is someone to be admired, was not the role model that I was seeking.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I think we could use a little bit more of parents staying home with the children while they're being raised. And luckily, we have men that stay home with their children. So, you know, those roles can be reversed. But boy, seeing in today's world, maybe some staying at home and really rearing the kids would be a good thing. But
that's a privilege.
Yeah.
In today, when I was doing it, it just meant tightening your belt on everything.
Right.
And I promised my husband, he wasn't my husband at the time. When I first met him on our first date, I knew I was going to marry him. I just knew it. He arrived driving a car. I didn't know anybody who had a car. He was wearing a suit. I mean, I couldn't believe it. He was waiting for his bar results, and he was working for a Supreme Court justice doing some kind of surveying or something like that. And so he was wearing a suit. And when he walked up, car, suit, you know, taking the bar, as he was walking towards me, really, I just saw this little white picket fence spring up around him, and the little gate had like a MasterCard gold card on, and it was just swinging back and forth and back and forth. And I thought, plus, he was the most handsome thing I'd ever seen in my life. So I thought, this is it. I mean, I am going to marry that guy. So on our first date, which I do share this story a lot because the joke is on me. I understand that. But what really clinched the deal is Hank took me out to dinner, and he figured out the tip in his head. And to me, that was math genius. And I thought, this is handsome, picket fence, credit card on the gate. And can do math? I mean, I was just like, oh my God, could this be it? And I knew it was. So I told him right away that there were three things he had to know about me. One was that I didn't really have a career. I did work. I just didn't have a career because my career was going to be getting married, having children, and staying home and raising them. And then he needed to know that we would always live on his salary. I would never say the grass is greener in the neighbor's yard. I would never do that. His salary, we'd live on it. And I said, and the third thing is I could never live in a trailer, even if it's a double wide, because I grew up in a place where fires happened all the time in trailers. and people died. So I have this real phobia about trailers. So of those three things, I don't think he cherry picked. I think he thought, wow, this one's a keeper. It took him 3 years to marry me, but here we are 48 years later.
That's amazing. That's a great story. I love it.
You seem like you've always been like very independent, always a strong thinker. And you said in your story when you were talking down at History Colorado that when you're in New York going to art school, that there is the whole women's liberation movement was happening and you saw these women in the street burning their bras, but you didn't feel the need to, I think you used this description, you didn't feel like you needed to hitch your wagon to this movement. You felt like you could be the woman that you wanted to be, independent, and have what you wanted in life without being part of this other group and still be a strong woman.
Todd, that is true. In adult retrospect, I hadn't a clue what I was really talking about. I didn't know what they stood for. I didn't understand that they are the a movement is integral to getting lots of people on the same page and moving, not always at the same pace, but definitely moving in a direction that is going to be beneficial to one and to the many. I stood there looking at it, and the first thing that came to my mind was, do y'all just not want a husband or what? I mean, I couldn't believe the throwing around and the unshaven armpits and everything, because it was the exact opposite of what I thought one required, that the coquettishness and all of that. I've been raised in a certain way, and I made a very deep judgment about those women. At the same time, I am a controversial person. You can ask just about anybody who knows me. They either love the heck out of me or they see me in the grocery store and turn their cart. And I'm not kidding. Just turn their cart. Don't want to get into it. It's not that I'm in your face, but I need to follow my own path. And it's not always the popular. Sometimes it's been a lonely path, but I've persevered because I just kept thinking, well, one day there's going to be somebody else on this path. And that is how with my exhibit, I started out all by myself. And within 4 years, there were hundreds and hundreds of people. It was a movement across America of apron love.
And not just women, men too, right?
Men too. I discovered through the four-year apron journey that men as well as women are affected by seeing the apron. Their memories are as visceral and emotional as females.
So aprons, how do we get to this point where you have this idea that you want to write about aprons and you want to be a writer? Tell what led into that experience and what made you decide that you wanted to start writing.
When my youngest child went off to sleepaway college in 1999, I had been preparing for that day mentally, that that would signal the end of my career as a full-time homemaker and stay-at-home mom. And I had been thinking, well, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? I mean, you're not educated to be an accountant, that's for doggone sure. So I thought, well, I've always wanted to be a writer, and I think the first thing I'm going to write about is the symbol, the domestic symbol for what I've just done with 26 years of my life. So the problem with the choice of subject matter was I did not own an apron. I had wiped my hands on my clothes for 26 years like everybody else. So when I went to buy an apron, there was one apron in a thrift store, and that apron cost me 25 cents, and that apron changed my life. I took it home, I washed it, I dried it, and while I was ironing it, there was this connection of such energy and force. I thought I'd initially been electrocuted by the iron, seriously. And so I set the iron down, and I picked up the apron, and I began to look at what had drawn me to this apron. And first of all, it was the color choices. The body of the apron was this delicious deep yellow, periwinkle, bands, stripes, small bass tape stripes of red and turquoise, and it just all my color choices. And I thought, wow, she and I, we were the same. We both like color. And then I thought, ooh, and look at her sewing skills. They're just kind of so-so. My skills are just kind of so-so. And then I was thinking, you know, I'm replicating what she did for all these years, all the years that she tied it on daily as part of her domestic armor. And I am replicating what she did. I think she's trying to reach out to me. I think her spirit is woven into this cloth. I think she has a voice. And if I just calm down, I was not electrocuted by the iron. If I calm down, I would hear her. So that made me wonder if there were other people out there who thought of the apron as more of a canvas of expression, as a conduit to conversation and a linkage to the women of earlier generations. And so I sent out a postcard campaign to about 49, 50 people. And, you know, it was like, hey, have you ever thought of the apron as this spiritual connector? The person's spirit is woven into the fabric. The threads hold the apron together, but they also carry her voice. And I just sat back thinking, my mailbox is going to blow up here. So many responses. I got one response from a woman who said, yes, I have thought of that. So one person out of like 50, and I thought, well, what was different for me that I didn't translate to 49 other people? And I thought, I bet you have to see them. You have to have aprons already in your life that you are already relating to, like my friend Aaron here, who was the one person who responded. So I went and bought an old laundry basket. It took me a while in 1999 to find enough aprons to pile in there. And I put that thing under my arm and I took it with me wherever I went for 4 years. And when I tell that, people just go, not everywhere. And I say, yes, everywhere. I was at like a ball game, a Rockies game, and I've got that thing, you know, and I've got it there. This was before 9/11, so you could walk up and down the aisles of an airplane. You could smoke. I mean, it was the best traveling experience ever before horror happened and they locked all that down. But I would walk around the aisles with my basket, and then I'd sit down, and other people on the plane would rise out of their seats, and they'd come down the aisle, and they'd stand in front of me, and they knew exactly what was in the basket, the ties, the fabric. And they would say, every single person would tell me in 4 years, one of two things. They go, oh, that apron reminds me of, or oh, my blank used to wear an apron just like that. And the stories were prosaic. They were always about the proverbial Meemaw and Meemaw and her biscuits. And when you think of Meemaw and her biscuits, you think of recipes. When you think of recipes, you think, it just made my heart so happy because their stories were validating what I had just done with 26 years of my life. It was all about Ode to Homemaker. Then I took a tad of a turn and I became enamored, along with aprons, of rodeo royalty. Now, I am scared to death of horses, but I decided that I needed to follow like a rodeo queen through her journey to becoming Miss Rodeo America. So aside from aprons, I was also doing this side thing. Meantime, and I hope y'all are following me, and listeners, this is what it's like living with me. So meanwhile, the stories that I was hearing, the last time I spent encouraging the conversation about the loving homemaker, the loving Meemaw and her biscuits, when I zipped my lip, the stories took a turn. And while the storyteller's memory was triggered by an apron and a Meemaw type, they were telling me about the journey of the human experience. And I was totally unprepared for that. Meantime, I was taking photographs, little snapshots of the storytellers. I was writing down word for word what the storytellers were telling me, or they were sending me letters in the mail, because after 4 years, I was getting publicity around America. I was starting to appear in magazines and newspapers. You know, I was a curiosity, but also one that was very sweet. You know, that's how people were perceiving it originally. So, Miss Rodeo, Colorado. I go to the Miss Rodeo America pageant in Las Vegas, and there I meet a journalistic photographer who is also following a rodeo pageant contestant. And she and I began talking, and we came from very different worlds. She was in Hollywood. You know, I was raised in Greensboro, North Carolina. I had a family in Pueblo, Colorado. And she said, you know, this apron thing that you're talking about sounds real interesting to me. Why don't you send me what you're doing? And I did. And she said, you know, I want to photograph your storyteller. I believe that this, and she was very into the women's, you know, movement. And she said, I believe this has importance in the journey of who we are as women. And I hadn't seen it that way. So we met. I flew around the country a bit, taking photos of some of the storytellers. And then when I met to see her about the story, the photography, I couldn't believe it. They were stark. They were glorious in their detail and depth of color and what they captured. But these were not happy little storytellers, you know, standing there smiling with an apron. This was pretty much the exact opposite. And I thought, well, what am I going to do here? Her vision of the photography for the storytellers doesn't fit my Meemaw stories. So I spent, oh gosh, weeks and weeks crying and carrying on about this. And finally, my husband could not stand it 1 second longer, and he offered me this opinion. 25 cents for that one apron changed my life. Married to the right person at the right time, priceless. He said, you know what? This is two projects. One is a book, and one is something else. And that was it. The journey clarified itself. I went to a writer's conference in Santa Barbara. The first conference I went there as a humor writer. But when I returned 2 years later, I brought with me a project I called Apron Memories. And an editor there sat me down and she said, you need to quit showing this thing around. You were onto something so doggone big. And actually, Margot Faulkner does not use the term so doggone big. She has a vocabulary. I apologize, Marlo. Marlo told me to figure it out and figure it out fast because somebody else was going to jump on this. And that's what I did. I divided the projects. And one is the apron book, which is a love story to the apron. And it is everything you ever did not know about the apron, and more. Recipes, patterns, wonderful stories. Julia Child, I interviewed her. She's in my book. She has a wonderful apron story, and it's not what you would think. It's really interesting. And then the other became Apron Chronicles, a patchwork of American recollection. And that was 16 years ago. So the whole thing, 4 year apron journey, 16 years has traveled America, and it's bittersweet, but I could not ask for a more fabulous venue and care by the curator than what I've received at History Colorado as its final show.
That's such a fantastic story. And 16 years, that's a good run right there.
You know, when people say, I'm so blessed, and I think, oh, come on, couldn't you find something else to say? It's right up there with awesome.
She must listen to me.
Yeah.
Those two. But I have to tell you, in my case, it is awesome that America didn't lose its interest in aprons as a conduit of conversation and connectivity And I am blessed that I met someone who knew someone who helped me make a presentation to History Colorado. And so hackneyed, though I was saying those expressions are, that's exactly what I would choose to describe the culmination of my journey.
And what a wonderful thing to be able to bring it back home and have this be the culmination of 16 years in the state here of Colorado, be able to show it at History Colorado, which is a phenomenal venue.
The way I almost didn't make it, honestly, all those years ago in 2005, Time Magazine did an article on the exhibit. And they almost pulled the article because I refused to tell where the storytellers of the exhibit are located, were located, where they were interviewed, where they made their homes. And the reason was I felt if you knew where they were from, you would read the story in a preconceived accent, a preconceived educational level. You might be biased by the lack of the struggle sometimes with pronouns and verb tenses. You would make judgments. So I never revealed where they were from, but when it came time for this final exhibit, part of the pitch to History Colorado was that over half of the participants are Coloradans. And just by the nature of my apron journey and the finances of it, this is not a project that was privately funded, well, privately funded by me, but privately funded by an organization, you know, a grant, something like that. So it's 46 storytellers because I ran out of money at 46 storytellers.
Yeah, it's a huge financial endeavor to take on a project like this. It really is. I mean, logistically, it's difficult, and it makes sense that, you know, a number of them are from Colorado. Geographically, it was more convenient to be able to talk to people that lived near you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a phenomenal exhibit. I just want to stop and tell our listeners, you need to go down to History Colorado and spend time. I had the pleasure of hearing Ellen Ann speak, which she's been doing speaking engagements down there, talking about her journey, some of which you just heard, showing some of the aprons, and then reading the stories of all these wonderful people, and they all have an interesting take on aprons. And then these beautiful photographs taken by, what is the photographer's name?
Christina Loggia.
Loggia. They're beautiful photographs, and it really is compelling. When I was down there, and after it was a private, not a private, but it was a ticketed event to come see Ellen Ann speak. So it was just a small group of people because of COVID and so forth. But as soon as the museum was open to the general public, there was tons of people walking around, reading the stories, looking at the aprons. It truly is a phenomenal exhibit and a great accomplishment. And I applaud you for taking the initiative and not letting people derail what you thought about aprons or this idea. You just ran with it and made it happen.
Every time there was a stumble, I took it upon myself that this is my fault. I represent the storytellers here. They're doing a great job. It's me. I didn't explain it properly. I didn't get the point across. To have somebody just dismiss it as a craft show, and I would think, well, no. The reason it's an exhibit is exhibits, this is my take on it, exhibits reintroduce you to something you thought you knew everything about. And then it gives it back to you in a way you hadn't thought of before. Ellen Levine, on the CBS Sunday Morning segment, Ellen Levine, who was the first female editor-in-chief of Good Housekeeping Magazine in 150 years, just stunning to hear that, the first female editor-in-chief. When she appeared in Good Housekeeping Magazine, I approached Ms. Levine to write the foreword to the Apron book, to which she graciously and beautifully executed. And she held the book party opening launch in New York City. Huge moment. I mean, just absolutely huge moment. So Ellen Levine said in her interview, "You think you know everything about aprons, and then you meet Ellen Ann, and you realize you don't know anything about aprons." Paraphrasing, of course, but that is what my job was, to get people to understand that the apron, which had been blamed for, you know, strangling an entire gender from reaching their potential. Yes, many, many women were held back just by the times, the economics of what their families needed from them. They were held back, and no, they couldn't accomplish what they were meant to do in life. But for a lot of us, homemaking was our calling, and we love that career as much as you love your career and anybody else loves their career. So Ellen Levine, so generous to women seeking their own voice. I never doubted that Ellen Levine would be there for me if I hit the biggest stumbling block, or she was such a support, and she has retired now, but in my heart, Ellen Levine will always be one of the most special people out there. And it wasn't just me. You just have to look at Good Housekeeping, how many women they have launched, and she definitely helped to launch me.
And they gave you the highest acknowledgement, right? They gave you the Good Housekeeping seal of approval?
They did. They did.
And you have a phenomenal quote that ties in to what you just said. You said, "Aprons don't hold us back, they take us back." I love that.
I believe they take us back in the nicest, sweetest way. Mima and her biscuits. And in looking back, you cannot help but turn and see all the women behind you who are propping you up, and that your job is to turn around, face forward, take one elegant heeled foot in front of the other, and move forward. Because as my friend Beth Livesay says, forward is the only path that you want to be on. Looking back and saying thank you so much to the women behind you for their support, for still cheering you on, even though they never reached their full dream and potential. Blow them a kiss, turn around, and like Ellen Levine did for so many, make a difference in someone else's life, in another young person.
This journey of with aprons wasn't always easy from the get-go, because you talked about how you sent out all those postcards to people and you wanted to get their feedback or a story or something. And people, in a sense, kind of just told you when you were starting this journey, you know what, you have too much time on your hands and you might want to seek help, basically, right?
Yes, that was the opinion, that I was wacky. And I'd been called wacky before, but this was like certifiable wacky. And I just refused. I have always refused labels on me. You couldn't pin me down, just like I can't give you a yes and no answer, which drives my family to distraction. I have to say that right now. I thought by my age, I might have learned that. I want you to know, if they ask me a yes or no question, sometimes I will actually say yes or no, just to see the reaction. They can't believe it. I mean, it's like, break out the champagne. She finally gave an answer. So, yes, I've just refused to believe that if I'm interested in it, everybody else has got to be interested in it. And I guess that's also when I've taken these sideways turns, you know, the twists and turns of like the rodeo royalty. I found it fascinating because it is representing the rodeo queens are representing a disappearing lifestyle. I mean, I don't know what we're going to do if the West doesn't, you know, collapses for some reason. These are the women who champion the lifestyle of the rancher, the farmer, the rodeo rider, the bull rider, you know, the large animal veterinarian. I mean, they are bright, bright young women. And it will be a sad place in this world if we don't save the West and what it stands for.
Absolutely.
I haven't seen the exhibit because I just drove down today from Rapid City. And a lot of our listeners will not be able to see the exhibit. But when you walk into the exhibit, what will the viewer see and what should they expect?
The first thing you see is a very modern take on Taiwan Own. It is a neon that says the ties that bind us. And History Colorado have that made. That is your introduction. And in the atrium, they have created what is like a ball of yarn with strings coming off of it where people are leaving their own. They're using clothespins to attach index cards where they have written their own apron story. That's kind of the last place. People, they peruse the exhibit and then they find themselves sitting down at the picnic table, picking up that pen. When I go down there on my own and I'll see somebody sitting at the picnic table, I can't help myself. And I say, oh, so what'd you think of the exhibit? They just say, I just can't leave without leaving my own story. And I just think, exactly. That's it. You are part of the exhibit. It is a patchwork for real of the human experience. And I named each storyteller's story with an emotion so that you get it right away. This is an apron story of endurance. This is an apron story of compassion, of opportunity, of regret, of love lost, of personhood. That's one of my favorite ones, of personhood. The stitching that holds us together in these times, as in the times of 9/11. The exhibit debuted 3 years after 9/11. And I equate the years before 9/11 to we were like, America was like a four-legged table, and we were really steady. Steady. We had our issues, but pretty much we were four legs. With 9/11, we became a three-legged table, and we became so unbalanced and rocky, and we've been trying to find our balance ever since. In those years between then and today, the stitching that holds us together, that holds that patchwork of the human experience, it is, the stitching is pulled in some places. I think that that's just, we've lost our way. We're suspicious of one another. We're not giving credence to how much more alike we are than different. In other places, the stitching is too tight. I think that represents narrow-mindedness, inclusivity versus inclusivity. So in today, yes, I want you to see yourself in that exhibit. I want you to imagine your stitching, your bit of the patchwork. And even though you may stitch yourself next to somebody whose stitches are a tad loose, or stitch yourself against somebody whose stitches are a tad tight, north, east, south, west, we are all in it together, and the stitching will eventually work itself out. We will find that fourth table leg because we're America, and that's what we do.
It's beautiful. You definitely get that feeling when you walk around the exhibit because you're telling stories from all different genders and all different cultures, and each one has a story that, you know, you can relate to. And like you made that that analogy with the stitching, you feel connected to each and every one of these people. As I was leaving, I saw a couple sitting down at the picnic table filling out one of those cards that you have down there. It's an amazing exhibit. You should be incredibly proud of what you've accomplished.
So we were chatting about stick-to-itiveness and 20 years and never giving up. The challenge I discovered with an exhibit is if an exhibit represents a time period, the impressionist, that sort of thing, you know, you already know the kinds of portraiture and environmental art that you're going to see. It was a painting technique. So it could be different artists under that, but they were also, you know, within the a frame of a painting manner, impressionism. When you're representing an exhibit that's not about you, it's not about me. I represent other people's voices. And I have taken that responsibility very seriously. And there was a point Hollywood came calling to Pueblo, Colorado, even. Some young producers heard about my apron journey and wanted to turn it into a movie. I had to hire an attorney, a specialized kind of attorney, to learn that when you give something to Hollywood, you sell an idea. And they can change that idea any way down the road. So I could have ended up with, you know, aprons in the room of love. And it could have been all pornography or something like that. And it could have used my people, my storytellers, twisting it, you know, just enough with their portraits and stuff. So I backed out of it because there was no control. And I felt I owed it to my storytellers to always have control of this exhibit. So that's been the constant issue is, and I say this to anybody who's out there thinking that they're going to, you know, hey, you know, she's bright, but probably not the brightest one on the planet. And look what she's managed to do. That this is really a difficult thing to accomplish is to have an exhibit where it's not you. And art critics haven't read about you and your journey and where you went to art school and who you studied under and all of that. Instead, you know, it's an idea you had that you can't give up on. And someone explained to me that long time ago that what I was doing was like what an independent filmmaker does. They get a notion and then they get a camera. And they get behind that camera and they cannot live with themselves until they follow the journey that the camera is taking them on. They have no clue where they're going. They don't have a business plan. They hardly have any money, but they cannot live without going forward with this idea. They also have to know when to go cut, which is probably the hardest thing in the world. But that's what it's like. So that's what my journey was like. I had no idea for 4 years why I got the greatest pleasure out of aprons and meeting storytellers and, you know, taking their little picture and then staying in touch with them. It brought me so much joy. My husband said, I don't think I've seen you so happy. And, you know, up until that point, I was saying, oh, the day I met you is the happiest day of my life. And oh, the day I had my two children, it was the happiest days of my life. But this apron thing eclipses all of that. I mean, my family was just aghast. They said, wait a minute, how could aprons eclipse? But it was the volume of stories I was suddenly hearing and the aprons that were being sent to me in the mail for me to caretake. It was astonishing, like this apron that I'm going to show you. This is how it appeared, with a letter in its pocket. I mean, when somebody sends you something like this, and you go down to your mailbox, and there's this package, and when you open it up, it's like the apron, it's wrapped in tissue. A lot of times it had a little ribbon bow on it. It was like the sender wanted the apron and its story to make a great first impression, that it couldn't make it. You only had one shot at this, and they pressed it and wrapped it and then sent it on its way, where for me, every single day, my heart started beating faster when I'd go down to the mailbox and I'd think, oh my God, what's going to be in the mailbox today? I was never disappointed. I still get aprons in the mail. I still get them in the mail. What the common thread is, nobody in our family is interested in the one piece of clothing that really was the most important piece of clothing that she wore every day for her entire adult life. So I became a caretaker of aprons and a caretaker of memories. Hundreds and hundreds. And to say goodbye to that is bittersweet, but just like the house that we're now leaving after 38 years, somebody, a dear friend told me, it's not about the crown molding, for God's sakes. You can reproduce crown molding in your new place. It's about the memories. A niece wrote me, my eldest niece, and she said she understood my happiness and excitement at moving, and at the same time, my reluctance of leaving because the walls, if they could talk. And she said, but the memories of all your nieces and nephews and your siblings and your children and your husband, take the memories because we have. That's what I'm doing. I'm taking the memories.
Hey, it's Todd Pearson. Wes and I want to acknowledge our media sponsor, New Magazine. That's N-U-E. You can follow both the National and the Denver edition of New Magazine on Instagram. The National edition can be found at New_Magazine and the Denver edition at New_Denver_Magazine. Look to New for compelling stories from the world of art and fashion. Thanks for listening.
This is Richard Ingersoll, and you guys are listening to the Tenant Podcast.
I'm glad you spoke to the responsibility of presenting these memories, because in the end, that's all we really have. Like, everything else is replaceable, right? This table that we're sitting at, the objects that you really relish, you have some beautiful art in your home. But the reality of it is, things that mean the most are those memories that we hold dear to our heart, whether it be with our children, our spouse, or the many people that you came in contact connecting with aprons.
My parents did not throw away. Education was a big thing for them. And they did not throw away a single thing that any of us had ever written. And like I said, I'm one of six. And that was a lot of saving. And when my parents moved from the big house to the smaller house, my engineer father packed very precisely everything that they had saved for each of us in boxes and sent them to us. So when it arrived, it was my entire life. I have the first Father's Day card that I printed my own name in, that my mother did not have to write our names in. And so I took that experience. It's incredible to see. This was before, of course, you know, when phone calls were made, long-distance calls were made on Sunday mornings, and your parents lined you up to say hey to your grandma and grandpa, and it was like, move it along, move it along. This is costing money. Move it along. Hey, grandma. Hey, grandpa. You know, love you. Bye. It was that hurried and all. But every Sunday, you know, this was what took place. So letters were the other way in which you got to express yourself. And so that was it. I had a whole world of letters, and what I would do is, if I sent a letter to someone, like fan mail, that was one of my biggies, was sending letters to like Dr. Kildare, heartthrob, to like Dr. Kildare and George Maharis and like Route 66. Oh, goodness gracious. So I would copy everything so that I had my own archive of what I was doing in my life. I would say the one thing that I realized as an adult that I did spend much too much time on was practicing my signature as the future wife of Elvis Presley. I was sure he was going to find me. And I would write my name, you know, Mrs. Elvis Presley, Mrs. Ellen Ann Presley. I had this whole thing down. I did spend a tad too much time on that. But okay, so I have all this stuff from my parents, my whole life in my own handwriting. I did not call my mother to plan my wedding. I wrote letters. It never even occurred to me to pick up the telephone. It costs money. I didn't have any money to call her. So I wrote her letters on what to do to arrange a wedding that was going to be, you know, 2,000 miles away. So with my own children, having lived in the same house for all these years and having umpteen places for storage, I have saved their entire lives. They are married to, I have wonderful, wonderful daughters-in-law who are minimalists. And this thought that their husbands' entire lives are in like bins in a basement, this has them hyperventilating in a way that says, don't bring that stuff into our house. So my sons, they have to come to Pueblo and begin going through their own lives. And my older son has already begun that process. And I said, I'm looking at this, and even his room, it's a shrine to when he left home at 18 and he's 42. And I said, you know, maybe I did a disservice. You know, like his kindergarten readiness tests from preschool. I mean, there's a notation there that says by one of the teachers, did not pay attention to the instructions, has no clue what the question was. And I mean, my son is a very successful person in education. And I couldn't be more proud of him. And yet a preschool teacher said he didn't know how to pay attention. And so he said, no. He said, I just wish I had more time. You know, he works full time. He has to do this at night, driving down from Denver to Pueblo. And he said, I wish I had more time to get it done. Because what he has to do is call. What can I save that will remind me in a span of time? You know, I can't save a bin called Noah, 19, you know, 70, you know, no, he wasn't born then, 1981 to 1982. You know, he said, I can't save, you know, all of it. I have to save one or two things. And so I journaled their entire lives. If you said, what were they doing on October 6th, you know, 19, whatever, I could flip to that and tell you exactly what they were doing. And I loved it, but I can see that it might be a tad much for other people, including my darling daughters-in-law. Who only one of them has been down to even get a glimpse of it. And she went right back upstairs and said, you're dealing with that. I am not dealing with that.
It's interesting, you know, what we say, what we choose to save and how those memories play into how we continue on, right? When my grandmother passed away, I got this literally like this big box full of letters and cards. And I didn't know what to do with those, right? So I thought, you know, my kids might be interested in this, but I just have a feeling that they're not. And so it was sad to look through those and happy at the same time, bittersweet. And I thought, this means nothing to anybody else in the world except for me. And I chose that when I pass, I didn't want to have somebody have to deal with this big box of humongous box of cards and stuff. So what I did is I sat out in the backyard and with our fire pit, and I read through them one last time and, you know, slowly put them into the fire, because I knew that all those memories are still up here, right, in my head. And it's a shared experience that no one else in the world can share in except me and my grandmother and my grandmother's past. So it's all up here. It was a hard thing to do, but I was like, I think this is the best way to do it. Just sit here and think about her and reread some of our correspondence. And then, you know, always kind of keep that in my heart. I want to talk about aprons as objects of art, because they're truly art. And people might be listening to this and go, I don't get it. You guys do an art podcast and we're talking about aprons today. But I will tell you right now, in researching this for this interview, coming here to speak, seeing the exhibit, I have a whole appreciation for aprons. They're individualistic, right? To that person, they mean something. They have the stories and they're beautiful.
The apron that I am now showing is an apron I sewed. I believe in matching, coordinating my apron to my dress. And if I don't have an apron in the collection that does that for me, then I just sew one. So this apron, I took a tea towel, and it shows a woman with a cookbook, and it says, something's brewing. I don't know why brewing instead of cooking, but there you go. And when I decided to use this apron, I also decided to set out some homemade cookies so that y'all would know that I was expecting you. And, you know, if it were later in the day, these tumblers would probably be holding something else besides ice water, but they do have ice water. But one of the things about integrating to create an apron of expression, when I take something old, like the tea towel, and I join it to something that I have sewn, like with new fabric, with this particular apron, it is like I am connecting myself to her. I have other aprons that I have taken apart, the pieces that have holes in it or burn stains. And in replacing those pieces, I always hand sew it so that my stitching is more personal than just, it is me stitching myself to her and making her garment, her apron, usable 75 years later. And I think that's one of the things I get the biggest kick out of, is of all my aprons, I had to find hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of aprons. I had to find a means to divest of them. I couldn't wear all the aprons I collected in a million years. So I never thought I could give them up, because each one, I can't tell you where my glasses are, where the car keys are, but I can tell you every single story about these aprons. So in giving away an apron, I was also giving away a story and a memory, and I was just going, oh, I'm having such a horrible time. And then I hit on an idea. I create packages for young women that I meet, or someone that maybe could just use a little cheery boost of recognition, like with my Taiwan On Day, you know, an act of kindness. So I would pick not just one apron, but, you know, a grouping of aprons, and I would package it with table coverings, because I also collect that, and then patterns, because I also collect those. On and on with the things that I would collect. And by putting this package together and then writing to the person and telling them why I picked exactly these items, why they remind me of you and who the earliest owner was that I could, you know, match it to, that the biggest pleasure you could do for me and the person, the previous owner, was to use this stuff. Not get hung up on the stains. Someone told me one time that an apron without a stain is like an empty photo album. And I thought, if that isn't the truth. So I found it easier. And in leaving a home where, you know, I saved everything for 38 years, I'm finding it so much easier giving this stuff away, knowing who it's going to. And for History Colorado, we came up with this. It satisfied a need for me in the giveaway thing, and to help divest of the collection. If you're a member of History Colorado, then you may select an apron from the exhibit. And if you are a new member, they are offering the price of your admission ticket and even the extra ticket to hear my gallery talk on Saturday mornings. They're applying that to a membership. And along with that membership, you get an apron. So that makes me happy to think that not only are people supporting this wonderful museum, but they're also going to take home a memory.
That is wonderful.
And become the new guardian of it. And that also makes me happy because I know they want it. This is not detritus that's going to find itself in a black garbage bag.
Right.
That's really special. I mean, that's a special thing to share with people. At the high point of apron collecting, and you still get aprons, how many aprons have you had in your collection?
About 600.
Wow. A lot of aprons.
Y'all know you both just said wow at the same time. I was kind of expecting awesome, and aren't you blessed? Doggone it.
I think it's fantastic. And I like the idea, you know, I think people get hung up on the idea of what art really is. And like I said previous, these aprons are art. They're artistic. And it made me think about, okay, who wore an apron, you know, in my family? And I remember I couldn't tell you, well, on my one side of the family, on my mom's side, my grandmother White, I remember her baking pies with an apron. I think it was brown with like some white fringe that went around it. My grandmother Pearson, I can't remember specifically, but it seems like, you know, it was like a patchwork. But truly, these aprons being art, I want to make a connection here because I think people need to, a lot of times they need help thinking outside the box. They need help in viewing art and stuff that they might not be familiar with, but there's also art all around us. And our friend Bob Raglan, when we talked to him, and I don't know, did you ever meet Bob Raglan? Do you know Bob Raglan?
Didn't have pleasure.
Yes. He was one of the first interviews we did on this podcast, and we sat on his porch and had a wonderful conversation. But he put things really in perspective for me at the onset of this journey. He said, you know, the definition of an artist is anybody that does something well. So he specifically said, I'd love to pull this quote out from that episode, but he said, if you take care of the house and you're a housewife, you're an artist. And he looked at things in a whole different perspective than a lot of people. And I think that's important that people keep that in mind in the back of their heads. The art is all around us, and it's not necessarily this abstract thing or this weird thing. It can be something in our everyday lives, something that gives us memories, something that tells a story. That's just as valid as anything else. Storytelling, and we just had this conversation with another artist, has been with us since the beginning of time. It's how we passed on knowledge and wisdom and traditions. And that's essentially what the Apron Chronicles are. They're people telling their stories and how these wonderful articles of clothing affected them in their lives, a memory, or how they were utilized. It's multifaceted and it's fascinating.
I found it fascinating. But if I had been sending out 50 postcards and one of them had been to you, you would have responded. So that would have been 2 out of 50. And that would have been a real bolster for me.
I want you to talk about aprons and the Vogue connection.
There was a time where I was sitting down. I loved designing aprons. It was a huge creative outlet for me. And, you know, taking older objects with new fabric, repurposing aprons, you know, that needed some resurrection, all of that. And on a road trip through someplace in Texas, my husband pulled over to a fabric store that I spied, you know, as we were heading down the highway, and I bought all the fabric they had of this fabric that's black, has a black background, and then it's all these mouths, these lipsticked red mouths, you know, from the fabric. Not in a weird way, but, you know, it's just lips. And that gave me the idea to design an apron around those lips. And so I created an apron. I named all my aprons called Smoochie. And Smoochie was, I wore it from the very first exhibit at the Women's Museum in Dallas. I have a uniform. 16 years later, still wear the same uniform, black shoes, pearls, high heels, and my smoochy apron. That is my uniform. And that picture, a lot of people saw that photograph, have seen photographs of me in that apron. And I received a phone call from Vogue magazine, and it was some assistant, and she was saying that Grace Coddington, the executive artistic director of Vogue magazine, has selected Smoochy to be in a photo shoot. And I thought, yeah, sure, right. This is really happening. And they said, no. So they sent it a letter to my email, and it was July of 2008. And it says, hey, great news. Grace Coddington has shot the Smoochy apron for our 50s layout for the March issue. Please send the following credit information below. And so it was absolutely for real. So when you look at the picture of this model wearing my Smoochy, it tells you that she's wearing a silk blouse that costs $695. And she's wearing shoes that are like $1,000, and her pants are like hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And Smoochy by Apron Memories, $40. That's my Smoochy claim to fame. But it is one of my favorite aprons, and I just think it has such a sense of humor, but it's also for a particular woman to tie it on because it has an attitude.
Well, it's wonderful. And how fantastic. I mean, to have a high fashion magazine like Vogue acknowledge that aprons are fashionable.
Right.
That they're fashion, right?
Yes. Yes.
And it's a cool apron. Like, I love that apron.
Well, I actually have a few left that I'm trying to push on people for Mother's Day.
There you go, Todd.
There you go.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I like that idea.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
I want to, your aprons have also had been famous in other ways. So tell us about that. I guess they were part of a TV show at one point. That there's someone that had one of your aprons was wearing it?
In the long ago world, I'm not even sure when Desperate Housewives first premiered, but the hype on this show was so huge. And I watched that first episode and I thought, that homemaker, that redhead named Bree Vandekamp, she should be wearing my aprons. And I thought, how do you get a hold of Hollywood? So I started sending out emails asking, does anybody know how you get a hold of somebody in Hollywood who dresses the actresses on TV shows? And somebody actually wrote me back and said, I know of someone who knows someone who knows the wardrobe mistress for that show. That's what they're called. So they got me, this person passed on her information, and I took photographs, you know, and I had to have help with the scanning, I'm sure. I mean, there's no way I could have done it on my own back then. And so I sent them photographs of my aprons that I was, you know, sewing and saying, I think Bree Vandekamp would just be perfect. And they bought some of my aprons, which I have saved two of them. And I've made little note copies of the episode that they were in. And the email that I received from the wardrobe mistress, you know, telling me of her selection and all. I'm saving one for my two-year-old granddaughter. I have already sewn her first little apron, but this will be one for way down the road. And I don't think we're going to be getting, I don't know for sure, but another little granddaughter. I'm going to keep it just in case. But next up is a little boy, so I don't know. But I've saved two. If I don't get another granddaughter to leave one to, then I'm going to find the best girl out there who's going to have one of the aprons that Bree Vandekamp wore.
That's awesome. My wife and I just binge watched that probably about oh, probably 6-8 months ago.
Oh my gosh.
The whole series. So yeah, I know who you're talking about.
I know. Well, you probably saw her in apron.
I can guarantee you I saw your apron.
I bet you have.
Yeah.
No, it was a huge outlet for me. I loved picking the fabrics. And one of my signatures was using old hankies, another thing I collected, using old hankies as the decorative part of the pocket. I loved how it brought in something modern, something old, something new. I love that part of it.
Yeah.
I want to talk about another interesting connection that you have, and that's to the author Jack Canfield, the famous Chicken Soup for the Soul series.
I went to my first writer's conference in Santa Barbara because I'd never been to California. I heard Santa Barbara was really nice. And I actually knew someone who had had huge success from her appearances and the connections that she made at that conference. So when I went, let me backtrack. The process for the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, what it used to be was they had a call out. And it was, you know, here we have 10 books in production and send us your story. And they got thousands of stories. And out of that, they gleaned a certain number. I'll say 150. And out of that 150, they had readers who selected the stories that would go into the particular volume that, you know, they were working on. And my first published piece was Chicken Soup for the Parent Soul. And the day that the mail lady delivered the envelope, I was outside, and there it said on the, you know, return, Chicken Soup for the Soul. She stood there with me as I opened this envelope, and it was, Dear Ellen Ann, congratulations. And she and I grabbed each other's hands and did this dance thing in my driveway. She was as excited for me because I'd been telling everybody how much I wanted to be a writer. So I go to this conference in Santa Barbara, and Jack Canfield is the speaker. And this particular segment was open to the Santa Barbara public. And there were hundreds and hundreds of people in this huge space. And I was sitting like way in the back. And Jack Canfield gave his, you know, talk about Chicken Soup for the Soul and how he and his partner, Victor Hansen, how they made it all happen. And people asked questions and stuff. And then he said, okay, I have time for one more comment. And he said, and this has to be the person who, if they don't stand up right now, this second, they are going to be kicking themselves for the rest of their lives. And I popped out of my seat. And I mean, I was just loathe. All these people turned around and looked at me. It was just horrifying. And they have to pass a mic back to me. Oh, my God. And the whole time I'm thinking I'm going to die. I'm going to have a heart attack here. My heart was beating way too fast. And when I took hold of that microphone, and he was like a dot. I was so far away. And he just zoned right in on me. And I said, I just want you to know, Mr. Ken, you know, Mr. What is his name? I just want you to know, Jack Canfield, Mr. Canfield. I just want you to know that you have a series, Chicken Soup for the Soul, but what you did by selecting my story was Chicken Soup for my Soul. You gave me the validation that I needed that I could tell a story, but more importantly, I could write a story. And that, yes, they're formulaic, and I could tell a story to that formula, and I could write it as well. And I told him about dancing in the driveway with the mail lady, how excited she was. And then he told me the story of the first piece that he had ever published. And he is a very humble person and very encouraging to everyone. And so much so that I appeared in a second version of his series. And it's Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul. And I wrote a story about my mother squeezing into a girdle and doing that dance that every woman knows as you're trying to move move those spanks or move that girdle up. And it's a dance, and watching her move it and then put on her dress and let us zip her up. And then she'd apply her Revlon red lipstick and all. And she was so glamorous. She looked like Sophia Loren. And it's just an ode to my mother. I felt that I got lucky enough that with the apron book, I still was able to write something complimentary about my mother, because it does come off a tad harsh that she was not my role model. She was in many ways, of course, but when it came to a career, no. So I was able, not only I glorified her in this story, and it's one of my most favorite things I've ever written, because I can still see her doing that dance and applying that lipstick. It's just wonderful. But from that, Jack Canfield did a different book, and I was invited to participate. And the name of the book is You've Got to Read This Book, 55 People Tell the Story of the Book That Changed Their Life. And the book that changed my life was Gone with the Wind, but not for the reason that people think it might have been. It's because I saw in Scarlett O'Hara, I saw somebody just like me who had been raised to be a coquettish cherry on top to some man. And yet what she did, while the world collapsed around her and every coddled man and woman in the South collapsed, not knowing what to do with it, you know, with what was happening, she figured out a way to save the one thing her daddy had told her never lose, and it's the land that the plantation was built on. And that kind of spirit and verve, I thought, I relate to that. People look at me and see one thing, but inside, I'm an entirely different girl. I also related to the author of Gone with the Wind, Margaret Mitchell, who, let me very quickly look through here, because it's surprising who Margaret Mitchell was. I looked her up, and I'd read that she'd been a storyteller and writer her entire life, in parenthesis, like me. She wasn't a student of note, and mathematics were her undoing. Mine, too. She was spirited, flirtatious, and charming. Again, I was excited by our similarities, and I continued reading. Margaret Mitchell did not want, she didn't think she had a book worth publishing. She was in an accident. Her leg was broken. She had to lie in bed for months and months and months. Her husband brought books from the library, and finally she'd read everything. And he brought her a typewriter and some paper and said, you're just going to have to start writing your own book, honey, because there's nothing left at the library. And she wrote Gone with the Wind, never imagining anybody in the world was going to read it. And of course, it's turned out to be the best-selling book of all time. So in my closing, I related to her that she never thought anybody would want to read a single word that she wrote. She wrote just for herself, and surprise, surprise, awesome and blessed, she wrote a book that is unforgettable. So for my closing paragraph, if you'll indulge me, I owe the attainment of my life's goals and the pursuit of those still to be envisioned to the serenely clever Harriet Nelson and to Gone with the Wind's two strong women, Margaret Mitchell, and of course, Scarlett O'Hara, that belle with balls who taught me that anything is possible, because after all, tomorrow is another day.
And when you said that about Gone with the Wind, that was the line that came to mind, because when Scarlett O'Hara, and at the closing scene when Rhett Butler leaves, she says, tomorrow's another day. And I love that piece. So, yeah.
Thank you. It is the watchword of who I am. I get teary when I read that. I get choked up because I'm lucky. I had a huge support system. I have an encouraging husband. I have sons who believed their mom could do anything. And I took that as, well, how can you fail? I am the product of so much failure, it's crazy. But I always thought, what do you learn from failure? You learn how to get back on the bike. And if you don't, that's your own doggone fault. But failure has been very good to me. It's been important to me.
Yeah.
I think failure is an important facet. Success is great, but it's the failures where you really get the education and really learn from those experiences to figure out the next piece of the puzzle, right?
My generation likes to make things easier for our children. I understand that. I really do. My children would say, you do? Well, you sure didn't make it easy for us. But my husband and I just believed that growing up in the era of everybody gets a trophy because we're all participants and we're all doing our best. And my kids would be standing there going, well, yeah, that's nice, but who won? What was the score? And they'd be saying, no, you don't understand. It's we're all a team. And they'd say, well, yes, but who won? So we expected them to be team players and to do their best for the team and then to do their best for their own visions. And I think that they have done that. And they are contributing human beings to the planet. And we're really proud of them. But they've had their failures along the way also. We picked them up from a couple of them, dusted them off, and sent them back out there. We did not offer their childhood rooms back again, except for a two-week stay, as one of my children said. When we tell people that, they're just aghast. And I said, well, Dad and I figured the longer you stayed, the less you would believe that you had it in you to get back out there. And because you were never emotionally or physically abused by a partner or, you know, a work situation, there was no excuse for you to give up on yourself. So we were going to give them 2 weeks, but we never had to really pull that off. But we said 2 weeks would be the max. And, you know, then get back out there and figure it out. Our boys have the most fabulous orthodontia. They have the most gorgeous smiles and college educations. And quite frankly, you can go a long way with those two attributes.
We've been talking about your Apron Chronicles. As I was thinking about doing this interview, and as I walked around the exhibit last weekend, I thought it'd be great if I could get you to share a couple stories from your book. Would you be willing to do that? And I picked out a couple that I thought were really interesting. It was the story of the farrier. Do you have that one available? Is that one?
Yes, he's in this book. In my exploration of rodeo royalty, I also became enamored of the cowgirl camps that were just beginning. And there was a cowgirl camp run out east of Pueblo by a very accomplished trick rider and, two trick riders. And it was through the one trick rider, Linda Schultz, that I learned about her husband and her son, who were farriers. This is one of the longer stories. I'm going to paraphrase in looking at the photograph that Christina took. It is the father and son standing outside with horses in the background and a horse trailer, which holds their farrier, all the things that they need to do the farrier work. And farrier, for people who don't know, and I sure did not, that's the professional word for horseshoer. And Paul, the father, talked about the chaps that he had from his grandfather and how they were indestructible and how his grandfather brought them back from Germany and how that pair was made, patched, and then cut to eventually fit his own child. And the history that's woven into the fabric of this very sturdy pair is this farrier apron, he is talking about part of our American history that is very unfortunate. Pearl Harbor, World War II, just terrible times. And how happiness, the journey of this particular pair of leather chaps when they were remade to be the farrier apron for his son. His son is the last to carry on this legacy of farrying. I'm not certain. This photo was taken, 2001, 2002. I know Paul has passed away. I'm certain his son is still, very much out there with his family. But I don't know if as being a farrier has continued. But I am delighted, as I told his wife, History Colorado felt that this was such an important story, an evocative portraiture, that they created a standalone kiosk just for this one story. And it's hands-on. It encourages children to learn, some leather working, that kind of thing. It's really nice. But Paul's story is a very important story. There's a lot of faith in it. He and his wife were cowboy ministers and traveled the circuit. You've seen, the cowboys with their hats off before they bull ride or anything like that. They're not only praying for their own safety, but for the safety of all the riders and a successful outcome, ride the bull to the end and all that. So it's this is a story truly of Americana.
When you go to the exhibit, please seek that out, because I think it's a wonderful story, what he relates. I want you to relate, which I think is really pertinent to the exhibit. We mentioned early on about the preservation of the American West, and that's a great story, like you related, talking about that, and this connection of these people to their land and to a skill set that is very specialized and probably in some ways being lost over time, slowly but surely, hopefully not. But I want to talk about this day that you came up with, Taiwan On Day. And so I want you to tell our listeners what Taiwan On Day is all about.
Taiwan On Day, .. an apron, of course, is an idea that I came up with over 12 years ago. I was making one more too many pies for Thanksgiving, and I looked at all the pies and all the food that we were going to be sitting down with the next day, and it suddenly occurred to me that I had too much, and that I had a neighbor who had had a tragedy, and I had been ignoring, making myself heard and expressing empathy towards the situation. And so I decided, this is what I'll do. I'll wrap a pie in an apron, and I'm going to slip a note in the pocket to let her know that she is not invisible, that I have seen her, that she has been in my thoughts, and continue on a personal, to personalize the note, but just to let her know that I knew of her pain, and I was sorry I was so late, and recognizing it, but she was not invisible. I went outside my house. I had my apron on still. I walked the block down to her home. I crossed the street to her house. And when I went up the steps and rang the bell, part of me was thinking, oh, I hope she's not home so I can just leave it here at the front door and run and not face it. And just as I was leaving, and I was at the end of the sidewalk, she opened the door and saw the apron wrapped pie and picked it up and looked at me. And I don't know what I was expecting, but she smiled and waved. And then she just closed the door and went back into her home. When I walked that block back to my house, my feet didn't touch the ground. I was so happy. And I thought, whoa, this is weird. I just did something I should have done ages ago. And she accepted my gesture with such joy herself, recognition that her pain was not invisible. And I'm getting joy out of doing it, having done it. There's something about this. So I went home and thought about it, and I created the next year my very first Taiwan On Day, that putting the give back into Thanksgiving through a gesture of kindness to those who are feeling invisible is a way of really celebrating a holiday that is all about gathering and storytelling and good food and camaraderie that not all of us are lucky enough to have. And it has been a wonderful experience. I've met people who have told me how they celebrate now Taiwan On Day, making it part of their family's Thanksgiving tradition. And I don't think there's a greater compliment that I could receive than that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
I want you to talk about one more story, because I think we have these cowboys that we were talking about earlier that are farriers, but a lot of these stories come from people that have immigrated to the United States from other parts of the world. And it's very much part of the conversation, and their stories are amazing. And one of the stories that really that I really enjoyed and it resonated was Penny Wong Schultz.
Yes.
Lovely story. Can you talk just a little bit about her story?
Penny's story is an apron of opportunity. And Penny is a very, today, in today's world, a very strong, successful woman. She is partners with her husband in his dental practice. She has been integral to the building of that practice and the maintaining of it. She has two sons that she is rightfully proud of. Penny's story begins with such tragedy. She was 10 years old when her father died, and her mother did not speak English. The parents had owned a Chinese restaurant. And at 10 years old, Penny, before school, had to get on the telephone with the, the providers of the, you know, the food that they needed for the restaurant, the distributors. She had to get on the phone with them. And at 10, you know, her mother wrote down, you know, in Chinese what they needed, and Penny would translate it to the distributors. And how their family, the tradition was that whoever made it first, then brought over other relatives, helped set them up so that they could make it. And then it was their charge to bring over the next group. And in Penny's case, they brought over family. And she describes learning how to, in other words, wash dishes at the restaurant, where she and her cousins would stand on stools with grown-up aprons, you know, turned over and over and over and wrapped up under their armpits so they wouldn't get, you know, totally wet from the sink. And how being a part of that at such a young age, her family, she and her mom, the family that they brought over, they were all responsible for being successful. That's the immigrant in all of us, is striving. And Penny, I don't believe, ever stopped striving. It is so ingrained, and she was so young when this tragedy hit. But she is also very warm and loving, and she loves to laugh. She's a great cook. She is a great example for what is right about America, and part of the patchwork that she was a necessary voice, and I was very lucky to have found her.
It's a really lovely story. So check that one out as well when you go to History Colorado to see the exhibit.
One of the stories I did want to share with you, and this has always been absolutely one of my favorites because it gives you, and we're on the radio, a great visual. In 1899, my father was 6 years old and his mother was pregnant with her sixth child. My grandmother went into labor at home on their farm. The five children were sent across the field to stay at the neighbor's. As they crossed the field, the neighbor lady was coming to their house to be the midwife for their pregnant mother. As she walked past the children, she had her arms wrapped in her kitchen apron. When the six-year-old, my father, returned home later in the day, he had a brand new baby sister, and he was forever convinced that that baby was brought to their home in the apron of the neighbor lady. 1899, I mean, this is a farm child. He saw, you know, animals being born. He knew what it was about. But the family took this little story, and it is their most beloved memory of this man. The woman who gave it to me, La Vida Therese, I think is how you pronounce her name. She was from Golden, Colorado. When I received this in the mail and I reached out to her, she was still very much alive. I couldn't believe it. She sent me photos of what they all looked like in 1899 on the farm. You know, they had homesteaded. This is just one of the most historical stories that I have because it speaks to the innocence of a six-year-old. You couldn't find a six-year-old today that would buy this story. And yet in 1899, it became their family's favorite and most precious story.
Beautiful.
It's been an absolute pleasure to spend time this afternoon and for you to share all these wonderful stories and information about how this all came about with aprons and the Apron Chronicles. The exhibit runs through May 31st, 2021. In case you find this later on in our archives, what's next for Ellen Ann?
I am asked that question as quite a bit. As I am being divesting because of this move, which is going to take me a while, my granddaughter is 2 years old, and I have so many things that I want to teach her, and nobody knows how long they're going to be here. So hedging my bet, you know, it could be I'm going to live to be a great old lady, but there's also stuff happens. So I have been seeking young girls to teach them the things that, to me, how to run a home, how to take care of your own apartment, you know, how to not eat over the sink, but to actually set a place for yourself to sew that napkin, to sew that cloth on your table, to sew yourself an apron to protect your clothing, and much, much more. Just a philosophy from the women of much, much earlier times. And I call it, I have lucked out. I have found a set of twin girls who live here in Denver. Hey, Maddie. Hey, Myla. Little call out to them. And we do something that we dubbed Home Ec Fridays. And it gives me the greatest joy to their moms drop them off and they come into the house. And first we do a little baking or cooking for the meal that we're going to share later. And then we sew something. And I love seeing them, you know, embrace that they can fix a hole in something by embroidering over it. Or we're so disposable today. And what I'm trying to teach them or demonstrate to them is use it up, wear it out, make use of it or throw it out. And that's an old saying from the Depression years. And I embrace that because we are in such a disposable society. And I believe there's a different way. And Home Ec Fridays let me work that out. So I'm going to be very busy with probably emboldening a little bit on my Home Ec Fridays and inviting more to join my little circle.
Nice. You know what I think? I think that should be a television show. I think you should write the treatment for that show and pitch it to Hollywood or one of these networks. And yeah, Home Ec Friday. And each week people can tune in and they can, you know, see you interacting with young women and men too, right?
Right.
And teach some of these skills that have kind of gotten lost and important things that because of where we're at with our education system and, you know, home economics and some of the other stuff that used to be, you know, taught in school have kind of gotten pushed by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
I would totally tune in. I'm not going to binge watch Desperate Housewives, Wes Brown, but I will turn.
Stressful, though. A lot of stuff going on there.
Yeah, that's not
scary neighborhood.
I don't buy into the drama. I'm drama free in my life. But I would totally tune in to watch Ellen Ann teach people these really important life skills. I think you should do it. Yeah. I really do.
It's every age group that I'm trying to put this together with. I have a friend who is in her early 40s, and she remembered with this whole COVID thing and all, she remembered that I had espoused once that if you can read, you can cook. And she had never cooked in her life. And during this whole year and several months, she's whipping out pies, she's whipping out roasts. And she said, who would have believed it? If you can read, you can cook. I certainly, that was a huge, you know, shock to me. So that's what I'm seeking. This is not rocket science. I have a daughter-in-law in rocket science, and I can tell you this is not rocket science. But what it is, it's a desire to, to give a gift of cocktail napkins, and when the person sees them, that they say, oh, did you sew this yourself? And you just can just touch your heart and go, why, yes, I did. And just for you, there's such satisfaction in that. Yes, you could go buy it anytime, of the day, but to actually sit down and make that pie or sew those little napkins, it's a way of saying, I took the time to think about you. And as y'all are leaving, I am going to give you, because I have taken the time to think about you, I created magnets of marital advice for a retro shower that I gave. And lucky y'all, I have two extra sets. So here you go.
Thank you.
And happy marital Lissy.
Well, I just have to say congratulations on the 16-year run of this exhibit. And thank you for stitching together some stories of Americana. We appreciate it.
This has been a pleasure. I hope our paths cross again.
They will. They will.
Thank you.
It's been a joy.
Thank Absolutely. You.
I would love that. Tell everybody real quick how they can follow you on social media.
My name is spelled, it's a long one, but it's the easiest way to find me, ELLYNANNE, no space, Geisel, GEISEL. And I am out there and I wait to hear from you. Let's tie one on together, an apron, of course.
And on that note, for the Tenant Podcast, I'm Todd Pearson.
And I'm Wes Brown.
Have a great week.
Bye-bye, y'all.